upon their arrival was almost unspeakable.
We brought all evil into some form or another.
I'm not guilty.
The dead won't bother you. It's the living you gotta worry about.
If I couldn't keep them there with me whole, at least I felt that I could keep their skeletons.
Hello, and welcome to the Bad Taste Crimecast. I'm Vicky.
I'm Janelle.
And we're back again. Barely.
I know.
Come on, 2020.
God, it hasn't gotten any better.
I saw something online the other day that totally described my feelings. That was like January 2020. It's been a rough year, guys.
Seriously.
For real.
I was deathly sick with bronchitis, and I still have a little bit of a cough. I'm still a little verklempt. You're going to hear me probably hack or almost choke on a cough drop today.
I'm just really tired.
Yeah.
It's been a week.
Emotionally, physically.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But we're still going to bring you guys a great show.
Right. Let's lighten our moods with a little murder.
Yeah, right. So with that, we're going to head over to the newsroom.
Fit to breathe, our food is unfit to eat. We sit watching our TVs while some local newscaster tells us that today we had 15 homicides and 63 violent crimes, as if that's the way it's supposed to be. We know things are bad, worse than bad.
Our story today comes from Wichita Falls. A car is pulled over due to a failed, like, turn signal use.
Okay.
And officers saw people in the car toss something out the window. Mm-hmm. So they detained both the driver and the passenger. The passenger initially told her officers that her name was Porchella Strawn. And
wait, what? Porchelle?
Porchella.
Okay. Just to make sure I heard that right.
Yeah, Porchella Strawn. So they checked her ID and everything. Actually, I wouldn't say they checked her ID because they pulled Porchella Strawn up and she had a warrant out for her arrest.
Okay.
And while they were taking her to jail, she said, actually, my real name is Sharika Strawn. And when they pulled up her actual name, she had 5 warrants out for her arrest.
Girl.
So she gave officers a fake name that also had warrants. I mean, it was a good try.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes it's hard to keep track of all of your aliases.
What kind of problem is that to have? Is that a good problem to have or a bad problem to have?
It's a bad problem to have unless you're like a secret agent, which I don't think that she is.
It just cracks me up because it's one of those times where it's like trying to get away with something and it actually turns out like slight. I mean, I guess one warrant compared to the 5 is like.
She probably didn't know that her fake name also had a warrant.
Yeah, probably not.
Otherwise, she wouldn't have used it, I don't think. But
right.
I've watched enough episodes of Cops to know that. That's how that always happens. It's like
they always give names that have warrants.
Not working. Oh, you have a warrant.
Well, Cops is something.
I forget what the new one of that is. It's like there's like they redid
Live
it.
PD.
Yes,
it's all terrible.
Oh, it's horrible.
Yeah,
I watch it with such outrage because I'm just like, this is racial profiling. Still,
there is. Have you listened to the podcast that they did after Finding Richard Simmons?
No,
the same guys did one called I think it's called Running from Cops. That's about the cop show, and they look at Live PD and kind of like how much bullshit it is.
Oh,
a little
it is.
Bit
because
it's total it's like total garbage. I'm trying to pull up the name for it. It was something like that. Running from Cops. I don't remember.
Probably.
But look it up. Anyway, we're gonna move. Yeah, Running from Cops. I just found it. We're gonna move on to Netflix to Kill.
Sweet.
It was a clean transition there. Mm-hmm. This week, we're going to talk about Aaron Hernandez.
Yay, I called it last time.
You did, yeah. If you thought we were done talking about Aaron Hernandez.
We're never done talking about Aaron Hernandez.
No, we are not. So, Netflix just recently released a documentary called Killer Inside, The Mind of Aaron Hernandez. It covers the cases, but also... cases, because there were multiple. But it also covers, like, interviews with his family, kind of his background and the background of the, like, organizations that he was with and, like, a lot of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one of the things that you said last episode was this was controversial, Do you remember saying that?
I do.
Did you feel like it was controversial?
People thought it was controversial. Really? I didn't think it was.
I didn't think it was either.
I didn't think it was at all. But I think that it was because they were the way that they were talking about his background in college football and his friends and acquaintances mentioning things about his sexuality, stuff like that, was what was controversial. Everything that they talked about, I already knew. And I thought they did a pretty good job presenting it because...
I thought they did, too.
To be perfectly honest, when that case broke open, I wasn't as interested in it as you were. I was kind of like, eh.
Yeah, I was real interested.
Professional in football player, bah.
No, it was crazy. Because he really did... I mean, when they lay it all out, he had this... father who was a big push in his life, but like you said, struggling with sexuality as this kind of like being brought up in this macho man situation, and then losing his dad at a young age and getting tossed into this like football life, which is a whole other thing, like the way that the athletes are kind of conditioned to be in these football programs. And the amount of stuff that they get away with almost. So it takes a look at a lot of things surrounding his life. And it's interesting that you bring up the whole stuff about the sexuality, because that was actually not originally in the documentary when they first were like putting it out into film festivals and stuff. They added that later because it is slightly unsubstantiated, although there has been a lot of people who have said, I've had these personal experiences with him.
If anything, I think he was bisexual, which is like, whatever, who cares?
Right. But it does add to this like pressure from playing football and the way that you're perceived. And like that, I think definitely had an effect on his choices that he obviously ended up paying for. It's really good. I think it's worth a watch. It's only three episodes.
Yeah, so it wasn't, take three. It didn't feel like it was too drawn out. So
no. So that was A Killer Inside the Mind of Aaron Hernandez on Netflix. Check it out. So this is that part of the show where we say content may not be appropriate for all listeners. We actually, mine is not like too terribly violent. I kind of... it's not, it's just like a quick little...
just a quick little killer.
Quick little thing. Yeah, it'll take me about 30 seconds. No.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So I was inspired because I was recently in Indiana for a birthday.
For things.
We'll say. And
that's very...
it was for a birthday. Not my birthday, okay. Someone else's birthday. It was fun. It was a good time. But I was like, we have never... it's our neighboring state and we've never like... taking a little gander at what's going on over in Indiana.
I mean, so when you brought up this subject, I had like immediate feelings of Cleveland.
Oh my
God,
yeah.
But like in a less enthusiastic way, like Indiana.
Indiana.
Because Indiana's like, you know, there's Amish country and then there's, you know, nuclear fallout.
But little did you know, there's also murderers.
I mean, I'm not surprised given the crime rate in Gary, Indiana. But true. Yes.
Yeah, it also birthed Michael Jackson. Speaking of Gary.
It also makes me think of The Music Man. Did you ever see that musical?
Gary Indiana, Indiana,
not
Gary,
Louisiana. Indiana, Gary Indiana. Yep.
I'm embarrassed the for what just happened. I'm very embarrassed. Actually, I'm pretty sure I have that on DVD.
Yeah, and then it went right into the Wells Fargo wagon is a coming down the street. Right. I can't stop thinking about the music.
Oh,
man.
Boy. So we are talking about some murders that happened in Indiana. I'm going to start it off with Orville Lynn Majors.
What a clearly Indiana name.
Very Indiana. Very.
Gary and
very. I know.
God damn it, music man!
So, Majors was born in 1961 in Linton, Indiana, which is sort of near the Illinois border. It seems he had a relatively benign childhood, although his teenage years, he did have to take care of his ailing grandmother, just like the situation they were in. This did inspire him to become a nurse. And male nurse. In 1989, he graduated from the Nashville Memorial School of Practical Nursing and then moved back to Indiana and started working for the Vermilion County Hospital in Clinton.
Great color.
Vermilion?
Yeah.
What color is that?
Like a red orange.
Ooh.
I feel an artist.
Well, I'm thinking, I feel like that's not the normal name for a color. If you give me a PMS number, then...
I know. We're living in two of the same worlds,
but I feel like
really.
I've heard that on Bob Ross.
Oh, yeah.
Like, vermilion mm-hmm. on the bottom of the screen.
It's beautiful. It's a beautiful color. It's the color of my walls in my bedroom.
Oh, my gosh. So, Majors would actually relocate a second time to Tennessee before he actually returned back to the Vermilion County Hospital, where he would stay. That's kind of where he settled down. And most people describe Majors as this really, like, incredibly kind and caring individual. And he was known by a lot of people in town because he also owned a pet shop in... Yeah, right. In the nearby town of Linton. So he was a nurse and owned a pet shop.
That is not confusing at all.
I mean, do what you love, I guess. An interesting thing sort of happened when Majors returned in 1993 back to VCH. All of a sudden, people started dying kind of a lot. Oh. Like, there was this, like, obvious weird influx in the amount of ICU deaths, like, as soon as he returned. And it wasn't really noticed until about 1995 when registered nurse and supervisor Dawn Stierick, who was getting a lot of comment from, like, fellow nurses that he was exhibiting some suspicious behavior, and she had her own suspicions as well. She decided to do a little looking and started doing research into a correlation between the days that Majors was in the ICU and patient deaths. So the spike in the ICU deaths happened between 94 and 95. In fact, and this is like, when I saw these numbers, it's weird because they did like this weird, like, scientific research almost into like numbers and data sheets and statistics and things.
Give me the graphs and the charts.
Oh, yeah, totally. So 100 of the 351 people admitted to the Vermilion County Hospital, which is like the ICU, is just a 4-bed ICU. Mm-hmm. So 100 of the 351 people admitted died.
That's very high.
This is compared to the previous 4 years, an average of 27 patients died of an average 354 admitted.
Yeah, that's a big jump. That's a big spike.
That's like 4 times as much, just about. Like,
when you have a third of your patients dying.
Yikes. Yeah.
You're doing something wrong.
Got a little issue. So Dawn Stierick, she did this research and saw that, in fact, Majors had been present in ICU deaths nearly twice as many times as any other nurse. Mm. And in March of 1995, she took these findings to the president and chief executive officer of VCH, John Ling, who promptly suspended Majors from work without pay pending an investigation. Mm-hmm. Now, as I was reading this, there kind of seemed to be this, like, almost a feeling of, like, he was suspended without explanation and was definitely, like, running this campaign to, like, try and figure out, like, why the fuck did they suspend me? I wasn't doing anything wrong. Yeah. So that was a whole aspect to this that was a little interesting. But following the suspension, the state nursing board revoked Major's license for 5 years for, quote, practicing beyond his authority by giving emergency drugs and working in an intensive care unit without a doctor.
Okay.
Yeah.
That seems like a good reason to suspend someone's license.
In the meantime, state investigators started looking into these cases. They had been contacted by the board, brought the state investigators in. So when they started looking into the deaths, it seemed like most were elderly and many followed the pattern of respiratory arrest followed by a rapid heartbeat, which apparently, because I don't know anything about medical things, is the total opposite of how that is supposed to happen.
Say that one more time. It was something and then respiratory.
It was respiratory arrest followed by a rapid heartbeat.
Yeah, that makes
sense.
And
that's supposed to be like flipped.
Yeah. So smothering?
Not quite.
That sounds smothery to me.
It does. Yeah, I guess that does sound smothery too. I didn't even think of that. Patients would also die of illnesses that they weren't admitted with, or they would like take a sudden turn for the worse after they were showing improvement or like were totally fine
Which, I mean, is pretty common. People seem to, they appear to bounce back before they die. Like, when my grandmother was in the middle of passing, she had, like, a few hours of clarity where she knew what was going on before she passed away. So it, like, it happens. It's very common.
Yeah, but not this many times in a row.
No. Not very consistently.
Deaths were happening approximately every 23 hours when Majors was there.
I'm sorry, what?
Every 23 hours. So, like, one a day.
That's
just about
absurd.
Yeah. When he was there, when he was present, the likelihood of someone dying increased 42 times. This is why, like, when they put together these numbers, I was like, this is fucking incredible.
That,
like,
is insanity.
Wow.
That is, like, an escalation beyond escalation.
Yeah, it's a lot. And this was compared to I didn't put it in my notes, but I believe it was, like, 531 hours on average for everybody else. Like, what?
Blowing minds.
Right. Friends of Majors indicated that he had a slight personality once he returned to VCH. And they
he had a slight personality?
Yeah, they said that he was, like, way more irritable and easily offended. Like, after he left and went to Tennessee and then came back. He was like,
I've always had the opposite when visiting Tennessee. I feel much more relaxed.
Well, and I'm wondering, because there were some allegations in some of the court proceedings that he was using drugs.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And so which I would totally, like, that would definitely be a symptom of, like, starting to use drugs, would be these personality changes. So I'm wondering if that had anything to do with it, but I couldn't find anything that was like he was definitely...
Yeah,
like using a
bunch
of drugs or something.
Unless they tested him, they can't really know for sure.
Right. According to AP News, quote, nurses and housekeepers told police that Majors would refer to patients' families as white trash and dirt and said old people should be gassed, end quote.
I mean...
Yeah, it's
like, I'm all for, like, assisted suicide, but, like... Not like that.
Right. Yeah. That's a little intense. By September 1995, police were exhuming 15 bodies to test for potassium chloride poisoning.
Uh-huh.
In total, the investigation into Majors took 2.5 years and cost the state $1.6 million.
Jesus. Indiana.
I know. It's like, oh boy. Indiana. Majors was adamant of his innocence, and he hired an attorney, Marshall Pincus, to run a public campaign for his innocence. He did interviews and, like, did the talk show circuits, including Montel Williams and Donahue.
Of course.
Yeah.
Classics.
Montel.
Oh, Montel.
So he was going on to claim...
Sally Jesse Raphael.
He went in to claim that the exhumation of the bodies was a witch hunt and that no one was murdered. I know, I saw that, it was like a facepalm. Like, it was definitely a facepalm moment. In the Chicago Tribune, Attorney Pincus says, quote, I think the state police see this as a case of the century, and they were bound and determined to make an arrest no matter what. I can't say why they went after Lynn. Maybe because he is homosexual, bisexual, and had been in... a few scrapes in the past. They have no concrete evidence. So that's one of the things that they really latched onto, because he was openly bisexual. Mm-hmm. But he was like, it's because of that they're trying to go after him, which it's not.
No.
There are cases where that happens, but this is not one of them.
Walking around in hospital saying these old people should be fucking gassed. Could that be it?
Yeah, right. No, that's not it.
Just openly calling your patients white trash. I mean, yes, it's Indiana, but come on. You're supposed to have some modicum of decorum as a nurse.
Yeah. Nah. So Majors was eventually arrested in December of 1997 and charged with 6 counts of murder and held without bail. Police did search Major's home as well and found vials of potassium chloride, epinephrine, alupent, nitroglycerin, proventil, broncosol, dobutamine, and...
That just sounded made up. Dobutamine.
I know it does, but it was on the list on the affidavit. I don't know what any of these things are.
Well, epinephrine is what's an EpiPen.
Right.
It's basically adrenaline.
They also found syringes and iodine prep along with some other various things.
Which at that point, it's like, why iodine prep when you're just going to murder
somebody? Because he's a nurse. He has practice. An oath.
Yeah.
He's got an oath to uphold.
You won't get any infections before
first,
I
first do no
you.
Harm and then do harm. No.
Do the harm the correct way.
Most of the potassium chloride containers had multiple puncture marks in the stoppers, which is quite alarming.
You can't get high from potassium chloride, can you?
I don't think so, unless it's the most wild high I've never heard of.
Because then I could be like, what if he was also just like taking a little bit off the top?
Maybe.
Nurses out there, tell us.
I have no idea. Oh, yeah. No, I definitely have some medical professional friends that I'm sure will send me a message and be like, this thing. Yes. So the reason that there was like the multiple puncture marks was also unusual, too, is because that's not a practice in hospitals.
No.
You one typically, you use the fluid once and then you dispose of the remainder. Investigators also discovered that while deaths increased when majors returned, the hospital was also, at the time, seeing a shortage of potassium.
My bananas! No, wrong potassium.
The bananas! Oh, no. Oh, no, Janelle.
I'm so sorry. I'm so tired.
They didn't have any special security at the time for, like, drug procurement, and anybody could just walk away with the drugs.
What?
The 90s.
Yeah.
Like, the early 90s.
Yeah.
According...
There's still some hospitals that...
Yeah. A lot of them do have the system where you have to, like, check in, check it out, and, like, type in all the stuff.
Yeah.
According to nursing director Judy Howard, the nurses mix their own potassium chloride, and there wasn't any accountability for unused materials also. This goes on and on with various doctors and nurses reporting drug shortages, missing needles and syringes. There were also reports of majors being in possession of needles and in suspicious circumstances. most of the time, these reports reference these syringes that he carried around with him in like a black pouch. To like
see, that just says menacing doctor to me.
Menacing, yeah. Ooh, that's a good word for it.
Yeah, like just like, I don't know. It makes me think of just really awkward B-horror movies.
Yeah, I could see that. So like I said, Majors was arrested in December 97. He was charged with the 6 counts of murder for the murders of Marianne Alderson, Dorothea Hickson, Cecil Smith, Luella Hopkins, Margaret Hornick, and Freddie Wilson.
There's some like Southern names.
I mean... Indiana? I almost forgot that we were in Indiana for a second.
I know.
A trial followed that lasted 5 weeks, hearing from 79 witnesses, including 23 doctors. Major's defense solely rested on the contention that the patients died of ailments that they had been admitted with, although the prosecution put up the case that the deaths were consistent with the use of potassium chloride, epinephrine, or both. Now, there was also... evidence of a study that showed Majors was present for 130 deaths in total, but the evidence was never shown to the jury because the judge just like didn't allow this in because they were only trying the 6. And I'm wondering if like the evidence itself, because they only exhumed like 15 bodies in total, so like it would have to be like written reports of stuff that happened.
Yeah, it'd have to, I mean, and two, it's hard to tell after someone has been put in the ground and who knows how long they've been
in
there,
right,
and the circumstances under which they died. So it was probably the ones that were very evident that they decided to try.
It took the jury 33 hours to deliberate before coming to a decision and finding Majors guilty of the 6 murders, sentencing him to 6 consecutive terms of 60 years, which was the max penalty, totaling 360 years in prison.
Yeesh.
Yikes, right?
Yeah.
Following
in
Majors.
Indiana prison, too. Woof.
I know, yeah. And it was like the Indiana State prison. Following Majors' conviction, the Vermilion County Hospital was renamed to Central Community Hospital, because I'm sure they did not want...
Stigmas.
Yeah, right. The hospital was also subsequently slapped with multiple wrongful death suits from the families of 80 patients.
As you do.
That were alleged to have died as a result of Majors' actions. Many of the suits brought by the family were settled out of court and paid for by a state's patients' fund, which... good. The state also fined the hospital for $80,000 for negligence and code violations. The entire building was actually like completely shut down for a time because it lost its accreditation, which I was like, oh no. And by 2009, it had been bought by Union Hospital in Terre Haute and renamed to Union Hospital Clinton. So it's already gone through like
a couple of rebrands.
Yeah. Majors, of course, ventured on his appeals process, but he had his conviction upheld in 2002 by the Indiana Supreme Court. So he returned to Indiana State Prison to serve the remainder of his sentence. He was described in what I found really interesting is like a very similar way to how people in the community described him, mm-hmm. as just like this model prisoner, basically, with minimal infractions. He had a total of 3 in 18 years, and they were all very minor. And he held various jobs while he was incarcerated. Mm-hmm. He did continue to maintain his innocence the entire time, and he had a few visitors. His last visit happened in 2015. Finally, on September 24th, 2017, Majors began having trouble breathing. And while prison...
Potassium chloride?
Well, I found it really interesting because while prison staffers were, like, assisting with a medical pass, Majors became unresponsive and eventually died of heart failure, which I was like...
Karmic
is right. Holy shit. So
that's it.
Yeah, he did.
He went out the way he came in.
He did. That's one of these cases. We haven't done any like medically hospitally cases in a while, and this kind of shit happens, like the angel of death stuff happens way more, I think, than people realize, than anybody, I think, wants to think about. So it's the story of...
So I don't trust hospitals or doctors or anything.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, right.
Just take some Robitussin and rub some Vicks on it and you're good to go.
Oh, my God.
No?
Yeah, Vicks solves all the problems.
It does. So, the case that I'm covering is a doozy.
Okay.
Because there's corruption,
ooh.
Meddling reporters,
ooh.
Gossipy neighbors.
Gossip.
But also that the victims weren't necessarily squeaky clean and innocent.
Innocent.
So, I mean...
I'm providing your backup right now.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
This is Film Noir Corner with Janelle.
Janelle.
I mean, don't get me wrong. 3 dudes did die.
Oh.
In a pretty brutal way.
Okay.
But you're not going to feel super bad at the end of the story because they were dead. Just wait.
I'm anxious for this roller coaster of a story.
I am all about victims' rights and advocacy, but this is kind of like, well...
Karmic? Is that actually the theme of our episode?
Is Indiana.
Karmic.
The karmic place.
Oh my gosh. What if Indiana was the like karmic center of the world this whole time and nobody knew it?
Ugh, that explains so much. Why all the Amish live there.
Oh my God, it would explain so much.
There's a large population of Amish people. Go see Shipshawana and have some pie and fried chicken because it's delightful.
Yeah.
So, this takes place in 1971, and it stars 3 men. Robert Gearson, or no, not Gearson, Gearcy. I'm just filling in the blanks. Start over.
It's whatever
Robert
you want it
Gearcy,
to be.
Robert Gearcy, Robert Hinson, and James Barker. They were your average white dudes in Indiana, very bro-y by 1970s standards.
I would say by that hairstyle, those hairstyles.
Yes, very like Don Draper level kind of douchebaggery. They were what we would call now toxic masculine men.
Oh boy.
They were between the ages of 27 and 34, and they were known around town as rebel rousers.
Okay.
So Gearcy and Hinson lived together in a swank bachelor pad on LaSalle Street. Barker lived just down the road in his very own house, and the 3 had previously worked together at Bell and Howell Company in Chicago before they moved to the plant in Indianapolis. Bell and Howell Company were a microfilm business.
Okay, like
film? Microfilm, microfiche.
Okay, all of the things
that you see at a library. I get to play with this stuff at my job.
Lucky you. Did you feel a special connection to this?
I did. I love microfilm. I'm that nerd who will go into the library and be like, excuse me, can I please see your microfilm machine?
I don't think I've ever used a microfilm machine for literally anything.
Just the noises it makes.
Yeah, but internet.
Clicking of the buttons. No.
Internet.
Everything is not on the internet. Proven by the fact that I've had to digitally upload and archive things from microfilm.
Fair enough.
So that's the beauty and the glory of it. You don't get that click that the internet cannot provide to you.
I hope not, because that probably means there's something wrong with your computer.
That's right. Anyway, that's microfilm corner with Janelle. So on November of 1971, the Roberts started their own microfilm business called Bob and Bob Microfilming Service.
I love it.
Yes. B&B for short. And the three amigos would start having raging parties and celebrating because they all had this awesome new job and they were on their own and they didn't give a fuck. So they were drinking all night, listening to music turned all the way up, much to the chagrin of their neighbors who constantly called the cops and complained about it.
Of course.
They did nothing.
What year was this?
1971.
Okay.
Yeah. So
this is still when you had in the regular ass neighborhoods, you still had some of those Leave It to Beaver families that were just
yes.
Those kids are being way too loud.
Especially
it's 7 o'clock.
Indiana.
Oh my
Suburban
God. Yeah,
Indiana.
True.
So they were, having crazy ragers.
Crazy. What does that even entail in the 70s?
A lot of highballs and dancing swankily with each other.
Yeah.
But the other thing that they would do is they would go out to bars a lot and they would pick fights with people.
Okay.
On purpose.
So these kind of rowdy boys.
Yeah, on purpose, try to get somebody to punch them. I was like, oh boy. So they were not just, businessmen. They were causing a ruckus. But they were also players, ladies' men, if you know what I mean.
Ew.
So this is why I think this story is not that sad, because they would bed several women and brag about it nonstop.
What hussies?
To the point where they started a competition. They would see which one of them could sleep with the most women by the end of the month.
This is the standard plot to a movie in the 80s.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. But that's not even the best part. The winner would get a steak dinner. That's the reward.
Oh, my God.
For betting the most women.
Stop being so predictable.
A slice of woman and a slice of meat, if
oh,
you know what
Lord.
I mean. Yeah. So that's why this story, I was like, okay, I'm not so sad.
It's
toxic masculinity came into
for
my
real,
head.
For real. Oh my God. It's all so dumb.
I know.
It's so dumb.
Indiana just makes me want to have eye rolls, and especially this story. This one's an eye roller. So they kept a tally in a notebook inside of Bob and Bob's house, And the
Bob and Bob.
The last count had the total at 63 women, with Barker being in the lead by betting 25 women.
Oh my God.
Within a month. Jesus.
Wow.
So this competition would lead to a very serious issue, as gaggles of drunk semi-nude women would often be heard and seen fighting in and around the home on LaSalle Street.
Women would just show up and start fighting with each other?
No, they would bring home women from the bar and they would continue the party there. And of course, they were trying to sleep with them. So they would just be all of these really, really pissed, drunk girls, in various states of undress, fighting each other over these three douchey guys.
I just kind of imagined all of these women that they had previously betted showing up at the house. Why haven't you called me? But 10 of them do it at one time and they're what do you mean? And they just start fighting.
There was very
front.
Much that as well.
Oh
but
my
it was
God.
Just in the middle of them trying to
That's
sleep
hilarious.
With women, just getting crazy rowdy drunk. And,
I mean,
throwing
I'm feeling
shit.
Less and less bad as this goes on.
I told you, this
yeah,
is not that
real.
Sad of
for
a
real.
Story. So they were just continuing this nonsense. But by December 1st of 1971, the competition, of course, would come to an end with murder.
Oh.
Oh, we get to the murder. That morning, John Carnes called the offices of B&B Microfilming to speak with the two Bobs.
The two Bobs. Wasn't that an Office Space thing?
Probably.
The guys that showed up to do the interviewing at the end were the two Bobs?
Probably. Anyway. I mean, that's probably the most common name in this time period. Bob. So the secretary informed him that they had been working late the previous night and would more than likely be in later because they did that a lot. So Carnes waited and called back that afternoon. Now, the secretary answered again, and she seemed a little bit worried and stated that although they do like to party, this was extremely uncommon for them to not just, like, do a no-show. This wasn't in character. They were very dedicated to their business.
Yeah.
So Carnes decided to head over to the LaSalle Street home. And upon arriving at 2:15 p.m., he came across both vehicles still in the driveway.
Uh-oh.
You know, he noticed that Barker's blue Mustang was there, which was really unusual. He didn't normally spend the night because he lived, like, a block away. So Carnes decided that he was going to, you know, go up to the house and see what he could see. Now, he went around the back because that was, like, the door that people used. And he went around the back to the door. It was open. You know, it's 1971. Nobody locks their doors. And
fucking course. That's why these things happen.
Yeah. So upon entering, he found a really grisly scene. Hinson was found on his stomach in the front bedroom with his hands bound beneath him. Barker was found on his back in the bathroom between the two bedrooms. And Gearsey was lying on his back in the rear bedroom. All three of them had been bound and their throats slit.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So the head investigator on the case stated to reporters that it appeared that more than one person had been in on this, as they were like three giant strapping young men and they were
I'm imagining a gaggle of women these men.
That would be so very karmic, but don't think that was the case.
Damn.
I know.
Damn.
But Gearsey and Hinson were friends who had quit their previous jobs, like, together to start their new business, and they were working for a businessman in Jasper named Ted Uhland. Now, the two allegedly, when they left, had taken with them some of Uhland's clients, but also reportedly some equipment and cash upon their abrupt exit.
They were just like, this is ours now.
Yeah, so a little bit of backhand dealings.
Wow.
Uhland also, apparently you could do this, had taken out a life insurance policy on the men for $150,000 each.
Is that a thing that you can do?
You could. You can't anymore, right? No, you can't take life insurance policies out on random people anymore.
I'm glad that we changed that.
You literally could take it out on a fucking stranger. Like, nobody would care.
That's so weird.
It's so very weird. But because he was their employer, it was very, like, that's totally fine. Well, if there's an accident on the job.
I mean, that's still fucking weird.
It's very weird.
I'm so glad that doesn't happen anymore.
So, he became the prime suspect initially. However, detectives had no idea who could have worked with Uhland to have the men killed, because it obviously wasn't him. He had a rock solid alibi putting him in southern Indiana the night that they were murdered. So they kind of were like, all right, I don't think we could really proceed with this lead. So they decided to kind of look around and see who else was in the proximity. Because these men were sleeping with everybody.
Of course.
They were like, let's check on all these women. So they came upon this theory that the men were killed because they were involved with the ex-wife of Carol Horton. Now, Carol's the man's name. This is during the time when Carol, Lindsay, and Ashley were very commonly used as men's names.
Kelly would have been another one.
So this is going to get really confusing for a minute because there's going to be two Carols.
Oh, God.
There's Carol double L Carol, who's the man. Carol one L Carol is a woman. Okay. Just keep that in mind. So Carol, double L Carol, Horton's, his wife was named Diane, and she had been friends with Gearsey, and it was reported in a newspaper, like there is a photograph in a newspaper of her, like, bawling her eyes out in the front lawn the day after that they were, like, found just mourning, like, ugh, like having a full-on fit,
oh my
hugging
gosh.
Somebody. So that obviously made rumors abound that she had been sleeping with Gearsey and that her husband possibly could be a suspect.
Yikes. No chill.
They did not do anything with this case. They investigated a little bit for Horton and Uhland, but that was it. Nothing went anywhere. The case was fucking cold.
Really?
Yeah. The case went cold until 1992.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Holy moly.
When a, I'm going to put heavy quotes on this, reporter.
Okay.
She's a reporter. Okay. Named Carol, 1L Carol Schultz. She launched her own investigation on the case. Carol Schultz befriended Carol Horton. Carol and Carol.
That's a great start to a sitcom.
Yes,
Bob it is. And Bob, now Carol and Carol.
Carol and Carol.
The Carols.
So they went a caroling. Oh, God. Okay, God. Anyway. So she befriended him in an attempt to get him to kind of confess to the triple murder because she was very convinced that he had done it. Now, with the help of the police, specifically Detective John W. Layton, Schultz attempted to get Horton to confess he was in the home and present at the time of the murders. Schultz hinted to Horton that his fingerprints had been found at the scene, which was, of course, not fucking true.
Oh, my God.
She even attempted to get a statement from one of Horton's ex-girlfriends incriminating him and stating he was violent, but this never went anywhere.
I'm starting to sound like maybe he didn't do it.
I'm thinking maybe he didn't do it. She then went on to work with an inmate who was imprisoned in a Florida jail to assist her in catching Horton.
Oh, okay. Florida.
Florida.
Thank you.
Florida to Indiana. What can I say?
Oh, my gosh. Opposites attract, I guess?
Or like people. Yeah, right. So the man's name was Michael Lee Chastain, and he was a former Indianapolis man who was serving two life terms in a Florida prison for a 1981 slaying of a Jacksonville man. He implicated himself and Horton in a confession, which he also then recanted about a dozen times.
Oh, God.
So one of these jailhouse snitchy kind of things.
I'm looking to make a deal.
He wrote several letters to people about the case, kind of telling his side of the story. Chastain even went on to tell investigators that Horton paid him and another man to kill the businessman because one of them was having an affair with his ex-wife.
Oh, boy.
Now,
something doesn't smell right.
Yeah. The most fucked up thing about this is that they were indicted.
Wow. Okay.
In April of 1992. They indicted Horton and Chastain was the key witness. But in a preliminary hearing in May, Chastain changed his story. He testified, wait for this fucking whopper. He testified that the killings were plotted by then President Nixon and carried out by Nixon advisor Charles Colson with the help from then labor leader Jimmy Hoffa.
What the fuck? Are you serious?
This is a rabbit hole.
That's yep.
Tricky Dick. It's on the case.
Tricky Dick.
Tricky Dick.
Oh my God. I don't even, there's so much to unpack there.
It's just that just is like this where is would, all where, fabrication.
Where would Nixon even find the time?
Well, here.
Where would he even find the time?
He had a lot of hands and a lot of pots.
Yeah, he did.
But they were in the microfilm business.
Okay, I mean.
Microfilm.
Yeah.
Watergate.
Yeah. I guess that's a stretch, but.
It is a big stretch, but.
Okay.
That was the thought process.
Right.
Anyway.
I'm so glad Nixon made an appearance in this story.
And that Jimmy is, fucking Hoffa. That you is glossed totally, over the Jimmy Hoffa.
It's just
like it's right so, before he disappeared, too.
It's like, so what? Delightful. Oh, my God.
So, Chastain never explained the fucking connection.
Just was like, he's just like, this is what happened.
It was Nixon and Charles Colson and Jimmy Hoffa. Fuck you. So Chastain was charged with the murder of Hinson and Horton was charged with the murder of all three victims. It didn't make any fucking sense. Obviously, the case went nowhere because it was absolutely made up bullshit.
Jesus.
Just
I can't believe they got indicted
and
at all.
False information. Well, Carol Schultz was working with the police department, and she had become like their snitch, essentially, which she was lambasted for this because she has that's you're a reporter. You're supposed to have ethics. You're not supposed to be working with the police.
Right. Yeah.
And she was feeding information to that inmate and recording everything that she was talking about with Horton and the inmate, all under the supervision of the police. She was feeding the guy in jail fucking information. Like, she had case files and was, like, kind of leaving these breadcrumbs. And that's why all of that information he had was, like, somewhat accurate.
Right.
Because which of she course, was feeding it to him.
Of course we know that's not how these things work. Like, that's not how you get confessions.
Exactly.
By telling people what to confess to. Like, that's not how it works.
Precisely. So, obviously, the charges were fucking dropped. And oh my gosh. Everything went back to square one. So,
well, good. I mean, that the charges were dropped.
Carol Schultz was just, she was in the process of like getting a movie deal. She had written, there's a book that you can read about this. It's pretty terrible. But she was basically just completely, people were just like, no. If anyone mentioned her name, it would just be laughable. So she was completely just taken out of her own business. Like, she disappeared into the ether.
That's what happens when you do a bad job.
That's what happens. You did when bad. You have zero ethics.
You did bad, Carol.
So Carol fucked up. And in 2001, police received a letter written by Fred Harbison. Now, Fred Harbison had worked for Uhland, and he had died a few years later, and he left a safety deposit box to his son.
Okay.
It, apparently, the letter that was in the safety deposit box went unopened for years after his death. And then when it was opened, the son immediately turned it over to police.
Oh, boy.
So former Indianapolis Police Department Captain Robert Snow decided that he was going to try and do something with this letter. In the letter, it stated that Harbison was hired by Uhland to kill the men, but was never paid for the job. Harbison couldn't go to the police or sue for the money, and he was afraid of Uhland.
Okay.
So this is what the letter read. These two men I killed in their beds by cutting their throats, and there was another guy who wasn't supposed to be there, but I had to kill him too because he showed up. Ted was supposed to pay me when he got the insurance money, but he kept putting me off because he said he had lost some money, but he said he would pay me as soon as he could. The paper said that a yellow Oldsmobile was seen at the place where I killed them, but it was really my yellow Plymouth Roadrunner. I buried my boots because the tracks they found them because I knew they would match up on my prints of my boots. It was a little hard to read.
Yeah.
So basically, this letter
confessed
that he had killed the men and he had never been paid, and it was Uhland who hired him.
Oh my gosh.
Now, the police department tried to attempt to do something about this, but there was a lot of pushback. And because both Harbison and Uhland are deceased, nothing will be done about this. And the case is still technically classified as open.
Oh my gosh.
So, much like Cleveland, Indiana is not really great at wrapping things up.
Jeez. Or
doing their due diligence and, you know, investigating.
Wow.
But that is the LaSalle Street murders. And like I said, you don't feel too terribly bad at the end of this.
I mean, kind of not, but I don't know. That's, oh, that was a roller coaster.
Indiana.
That's how I feel. Indiana. If you need to get Indiana off your mind because it just sounds terrible.
Yes.
Listen to this podcast.
I'm Elisa Lucas from Best Forevers, a podcast for kindred spirits. I'd like to start a movement where we spend more time loving on our friends, because although friends are important to us, they're often in the shadow of other relationships. So if you want to love on your friendships a little bit more, embrace friendship a little bit more, or just appreciate your friendships a little bit more, then this podcast is for you. We'll explore all the different ways friendships take place, share the amazing stories of friendship, and discuss best practices for the difficulties that friends may experience. It's time to embrace friendships, because without our friends, who would we be? So check out Best Forevers on iTunes, Stitcher, and all the other podcasting listening venues. And be sure to follow Best Forevers Pod on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter.
All right, Janelle, that has been our show.
It has been our show.
But we do have some events to talk about.
We do.
We do. So first is the True Crime Expo.
Yes. I was like, wait, which one are you talking about first?
That's the first one that's coming up. Yes. So you April 4th. Know about that.
Yeah, I do.
Do tell.
So you remember that expo we were going to have in November that got canceled?
Yeah.
They have a new date.
Yay!
It's April 4th. It's still with Haunted Rockford and John Borowski Films. They're going to do a filming after the expo. It's from noon to 4 at, I think it's still Veterans Memorial Hall. She hasn't told me it's different. But you can go on hauntedrockford.com and find out all the information. You can buy tickets ahead of time or at the door. They're a little bit more expensive at the door, though, so maybe buy it in advance.
Yeah.
But we'll be there. Telling some stories along
with
some other...
We're doing a live show.
It's a live show, baby. Along with some other fabulous people. You can come hang out with us. Maybe get us some
merch. Are we going to dress in costume for this one? Can I wear a boa?
That would be pretty hilarious.
I know.
I could. I have...
You totally fucking could. We're not revealing what it is, but Janelle could do it.
I have clothing from like 1890 until the 90s. Like I could dress up in any conceivable decade.
Yeah. It's true. So you can come and check us out. Again, go to Haunted Rockford for more information on that show.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, what's the date? April 4th. After that, we are going to be in Kansas City, Missouri for the True Crime Podcast Festival.
KC, baby.
On July 11th and 12th. Mm-hmm. We have finally finalized all of our stuff to actually go. So, like, we're going.
Tickets are completed.
We're going.
Airbnb booked.
Booked.
I'm
excited.
Every place I want to go to has been put on my itinerary.
Yeah. There's a lot of great podcasts that are going to be there. They're doing some more panels. They're doing some more live recordings. Mm-hmm. We're just going to be there hanging out, chit-chatting, doing the thing. But if you want to get tickets for that, you can find those at tcpf2020.com. Again, that's July 11th and 12th. And I would advise getting tickets sooner rather than later.
The prices will go up as it gets closer and closer, but as that happens.
If you want a fun weekend, we're staying above a ramen shop. I'm super stoked for that.
I mean, there's going to be ramen. There's going to be barbecue. I'm going to hit up the art museum. I'm just going to do
the what
the
museum?
Things. The art museum.
The art museum.
Yeah.
They said the dark museum. I was like,
the dark arts museum.
I want that.
No,
I want to be there.
I have reciprocity with like 1,000 art museums. So anytime I go anywhere, I just go in for free.
Oh my God.
Bye.
Nice.
Yeah.
So check that out again, tcpf2020.com for more information on that. Do we have anything else? Do we have any, like...
I mean, you can check out our Patreon.
Yep.
We have fun stuff up there. Backlogs of all kinds of crazy shenanigans, cocktails, and conspiracies.
True.
It's happening over there.
Yeah, you can go to patreon.com or you can go to badtastecrimecast.com/donate. Mm-hmm. It'll get you to the same place.
Yep. Check out our merch.
Merch!
Linked also on the website.
badtastecrimecast.com/merch.
Yeah. It's spring. You're going to need a tank top soon.
Oh my gosh.
Maybe get some started workout gear.
Pulling my tank top out to play volleyball. I was like, I missed this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I started running.
Whoa.
Not from people.
Stop the press. Not from people. Stop the press.
I started running for leisure.
Wow. Go you, girl. 2020. Janelle's a year of, you know what? Fuck it.
Fuck it. I'm going to run. So I brought out my tank top to go running in.
Get it, girl.
And was like, oh, yes. I need a better sports bra.
Oh, man.
You know, the struggles are real.
It's been a minute. If you want to keep an eye on, like, the places we're going to be or the things we're doing, you can also find us on Facebook and Instagram, Bad Taste Crime Cast.
There's lots of opportunities to see us this year.
Or Twitter at BT Crime Cast for that stuff. We'll announce for stuff there.
Twitty twatting. What? Nope.
No. Ew. Okay.
Nope. Take that out. Recant.
All right. With that, we're gonna get out of here. Our sound and editing is by Tiff Fullman. Our music is by Jason Zakshevsky, the Enigma.
Hype.
Yeah. We will see you in 2 weeks. Stay safe. and have fun.
Indiana.
Indiana.
Gary, Indiana, not Louisiana. Gary, Indiana.
Young women have left their bodies on the hillsides along the highway. It was as if a wave of evil washed over this town.
We are all evil in some form or another.